tamste pratyabhigacchanti ye ke chatmahano janaha anijadikam manaso javiyo naina deva abduvan purvanarshat tadavato nyana te titishtat tasmina poma tarishva dadati tarejati tannayjati tadure tadvantike tarantarasya sarvasya taru sarvasya sibhayataha yastu sarvani bhutani atmani vanupashyati sarva bhuteshu chatmanam tato navi jagupsate yasmin sarvani bhutani atmaivad budvijanataha tatrako mahakashoka ekatvam manupashyataha Saparya jakshukram makayam avranam asnaviram shudham apapavidham kavir manishi priyabhu swayambhur yatat yat yator tan vyaradashasvatibhya samabhya andantama pravishanti ye vidyam upasate tato bhuya ivate tamo ya uvidya yamrataha Anyadeva hurvidyaya, anyadahura vidyaya, iti shushrumadhiranam, yenas tadvijichakshire. Vidyam cha yas, tadvedo bayam saha, avidyayam ritum tirtva, vidyayam ritum ashnute. Andantama pravishanti, ye sambutim upasate, Tato puya ivate tamo ya u sambut yamrataha. Anyadeva hu sambhavad, anyadahura sambhavad, iti shushru madhiranam, yenas tadvichichakshire. Sambutim cha vinasham cha, yastad vedo bayam saha, vinashenam ritum tirtva, sambut yamritum ashnute. Anmayena patrena satyasya pihitam mukam tatvam pushana pavrenu satyadharma yadrishtaye pushani karshayama surya prajapatya vyuharasmin samuha tejo yate rupam kalyanatamam tate pashami yosavasau purusham asmi vayur anilam amratam Atedam pashmantam shariram, om kratosmara kritam smara, agne naya supatarayasman, vishvani deva vayunani vidvan, yuyodhyasmashtu haranameno, puishtam tenama uktim videma. Now let's read the translations together. The personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, and because he is completely perfect, all emanations from him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced as a complete whole is also complete in itself. Because he is a complete whole, even though so many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. Everything animate or inanimate that is within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota, and one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. One may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he continuously goes on working in that way, for that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There is no alternative to this way for man. The killer of the soul, whoever he may be, must enter into the planets known as the worlds of the faithless, full of darkness and ignorance. Although fixed in his abode, the personality of Godhead is swifter than the mind and can overcome all others running. The powerful demigods cannot approach him. Although in one place, he controls those who supply the air and rain. He surpasses all in excellence. The Supreme Lord walks and does not walk. He is far away, but he is very near as well. He is within everything, and yet he is outside of everything. He who sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, who sees all living entities as his parts and parcels, and who sees the Supreme Lord within everything, never hates anything or any being. One who always sees all living entities as spiritual sparks, in quality one with the Lord, becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? Such a person must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure and uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desires since time immemorial. Those who engage in the culture of nescient activities shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Worse still are those engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. The wise have explained one result is derived from the culture of knowledge, and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nescience. Only one who can learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. Ah, yes. Those who are engaged in the worship of the demigods enter into the darkest region of ignorance, and still more so to the worshippers of the impersonal absolute. It is said that one result is obtained by worshipping the supreme cause of all causes, and that another result is obtained by worshipping what is not supreme. All this is heard from the undisturbed authorities who clearly explained it. One should know perfectly the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, and his transcendental name, form, qualities, and pastimes, as well as the temporary material creation, with its temporary demigods, men, and animals. When one knows these, he surpasses death and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it, and in the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys his eternal life of bliss and knowledge. O my Lord, sustainer of all that lives, your real face is covered by dazzling effulgence. Kindly remove that covering and exhibit yourself to your pure devotee. O my Lord, O primeval philosopher, maintainer of the universe, O regulating principle, destination of the pure devotees, well-wisher of the progenitors of mankind, please remove the effulgence of your transcendental rays so that I can see your form of bliss. You are the eternal supreme personality of Godhead, like unto the sun, as am I. Let this temporary body be burnt to ashes, and let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. Now, my Lord, please remember all my sacrifices, and because you are the ultimate beneficiary, please remember all that I have done for you. O my Lord, as powerful as fire, O omnipotent one, now I offer you all obeisances, falling on the ground at your feet. O my Lord, please lead me on the right path to reach you, and since you know all that I have done in the past, please free me from the reactions to my past sins, so there will be no hindrance to my progress. And now we'll hear Srila Prabhupada's purport in mantra number 2, which is on page 23. Kurvani veha karmani jijivi shakshatam samaha evam tvai nanyate tosti na karma lipyate nare kurvan. Doing continuously. Eva, thus, iha, during this span of life. Karmani, work, jijivishet. One should desire to live. Shatam, 100. Samaha, years. Evam, so living. Twai, unto you. Na, no. Anyata, alternative. Itaha, from this path. Asti, there is. Na, not. Karma, work. Lipyate, can be bound. Nare, unto a man. Translation, one may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he continuously goes on working in that way, for that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There is no alternative to this way for man. Purport. No one wants to die. Everyone wants to live as long as he can drag on. This tendency is visible not only individually, but also collectively in the community, society, and nation. There is a hard struggle for life by all kinds of living entities, and the Vedas say that this is quite natural. The living being is eternal by nature, but due to his bondage in material existence, he has to change his body over and over. This process is called transmigration of the soul or karma bandhana, bondage by one's work. The living entity has to work for his livelihood because that is the law of material nature. And if he does not act according to his prescribed duties, he transgresses the laws of nature, the law of nature, and binds himself more and more to the cycle of birth and death in the many species of life. Other forms are also subject to the cycle of birth and death, but when the living entity attains a human life, he gets a chance to get free from the chains of karma. Karma, akarma, and vikarma are very clearly described in the Bhagavad Gita. Actions that are performed in terms of one's prescribed duties, as mentioned in the revealed scriptures, are called karma. Actions that free one from the cycle of birth and death are called akarma. And actions that are performed through the misuse of one's freedom and that direct one to the lower forms of life are called vikarma. Of these three types of action, that which frees one from the bondage to karma is preferred by intelligent men. Ordinary men wish to perform good work in order to be recognized and achieve some higher status of life in this world or in heaven. But more advanced men want to be free altogether from the actions and reactions of work. Intelligent men well know that both good and bad work equally bind one to material miseries. Consequently, they seek that work which will free them from the reactions of both good and bad work. Such liberating work is described here in the pages of Sri Ishopanishad. The instructions of Sri Ishopanishad are more elaborately explained in the Bhagavad Gita, sometimes called the Gita Upanishad, the cream of all the Upanishads. In the Bhagavad Gita 3:9-16, the Personality of Godhead says that one cannot attain the state of naishkarmya or akarma without executing the prescribed duties mentioned in the Vedic literature. This literature can regulate the working energy of a human being in such a way that he can gradually realize the authority of the Supreme Being. When he realizes the authority of the Personality of Godhead Vasudeva or Krishna, it is to be understood that he has attained the stage of positive knowledge. In this purified stage, the modes of nature, namely goodness, passion, and ignorance, cannot act, and he is able to work on the basis of naishkarmya. Such work does not bind one to the cycle of birth and death. Factually, no one has to do anything more than render devotional service to the Lord. However, in the lower stages of life, one cannot immediately adopt the activities of devotional service, nor can one completely stop fruit of work. Let me repeat that. It's very important. Factually, no one has to do anything more than render devotional service to the Lord. May I repeat that again? Factually, no one has to do anything more than render devotional service to the Lord. Well, what are we all doing? He wants to hear it again. Factually, no one has to do anything more than render devotional service to the Lord. However, in the lower stages of life, one cannot immediately adopt the activities of devotional service, nor can one completely stop fruit of work. A conditioned soul is accustomed to working for sense gratification for his own selfish interest, immediate or extended. An ordinary man works for his own sense enjoyment, and when this principle of sense enjoyment is extended to include his society, nation, or humanity in general, it assumes various attractive names such as altruism, socialism, communism, nationalism, and humanitarianism. These isms are certainly very attractive forms of karma bandhana, karmic bondage. But the Vedic instruction of Sri Ishopanishad is that one actually wants to live, that if one actually wants to live for any of the above isms, he should make them God-centered. There is no harm in becoming a family man or an altruist, a socialist, a communist, a nationalist, or humanitarian, provided that one executes his duties in relation with Ishavasya, the God-centered conception. In the Bhagavad Gita 2:40, Lord Krishna states that God-centered activities are so valuable that just a few of them can save a person from the greatest danger. The greatest danger of life is the danger of gliding down again into the evolutionary cycle of birth and death among the 8,400,000 species. If somehow or other a man misses the spiritual opportunity afforded by his human form of life and falls down again into the evolutionary cycle, he must be considered most unfortunate. Due to his defective senses, a foolish man cannot see that this is happening. Consequently, Sri Ishapanishad advises us to exert our energy in the spirit of Ishavasya. Being so engaged, we may wish to live for many, many years. Otherwise, a long life in itself has no value. A tree lives for hundreds of and hundreds of years, but there is no point in living a long time like trees, or breathing like bellows, or begetting children like hogs and dogs, or eating like camels. A humble God-centered life is more valuable than a colossal hoax of a life dedicated to godless altruism or socialism. When altruistic activities are executed in the spirit of Sri Ishapanishad, they become a form of karma yoga. Such activities are recommended in the Bhagavad Gita 18:5-9, for they guarantee their executor protection from the danger of sliding down into the evolutionary process of birth and death. Even though such God-centered activities may be half-finished, they are still good for the executor because they will guarantee him a human form in his next birth. In this way, one can have another chance to improve his position on the path of liberation. How one can execute God-centered activities is elaborately explained in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu by Srila Rupa Goswami. We have rendered this book into English as the Nectar of Devotion. We recommend this valuable book to all who are interested in performing their activities in the spirit of Sri Ishapanishad. It's amazing, isn't it? Because we're so protected by the... this is partly what it means to be under the protection of the divine nature. Mahatmanastumam parta daivim prakriti mashrita. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that this daivi prakriti gives one shelter. And part of that shelter is how Krishna's message is coming to us in the varieties of forms that were just mentioned in this purport. In the Bhagavad Gita, we have Krishna's direct words, which Prabhupada mentioned as being called the Gita Upanishad. And Krishna's speaking himself. Satyadev Prabhu and I were just reading on last night, Tuesday night, from the Bhagavad Gita second chapter, second half of the second chapter. And Satyadev Prabhu was remarking how profound Krishna's words are. Every time you read them, each time they give new insight and direction. Then, as Srila Prabhupada mentions here, we have the Nectar of Devotion, which is a complete description of how to live a God-centered life in full detail of how to regulate one's life in devotional service. This devotional process in the Vaidhi Bhakti, which means rules and regulations, Prabhupada is described as a pushing process. Because it's just like a car. When a car stalls, sometimes you have to push it. Can you still do that with cars? In the old days, we if someone's car stalled, three of us, you can't do it with automatics, three of us would get out and jump behind the car and run and push, and then they let out the clutch and then boom, and start again, you know. So Prabhupada said, just like that, sometimes the car stalls, you need to push. So Vaidhi Bhakti is a pushing process. But once the car starts, boom, 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 and then, you know, the engine starts going again, then you have some taste and you're going on your own. It's the natural inclination, actually. It is our natural inclination to go in that direction. It's just become stalled somehow or other. So we're protected. And this solves all problems. Sri Ishapanishad solves all the problems of life in one fell swoop. It gives us the where our center of attention should be. Brahmanot hi pratishtaham amritasya yavayasya cha shashvatasya cha dharmasya sukasya kantikasya cha. Krishna says at the end of the, what is that, 14th chapter? No, it's not 16th or 17th. Must be the end of the 14th chapter. Brahmanohi pratishtaham. Yeah. End of the 14th chapter. Amritasya vichasticha. It means Krishna is saying he's what's behind everything. He's the source of everything. Everything's resting on him. The Brahman effulgence comes from him. He's the source of ultimate happiness. And there's only one difficulty for the soul in the material world who has forgotten this, and that is that he has many different ideas of what is the goal. So as soon as my goal becomes Ishavasya, centered on Isha, the Supreme Controller, Krishna, then all difficulties are dried up. And whatever activities I was doing before, I can still do them, but when they become centered on Krishna, then they're non-reactive, and there's no more difficulty. So this verse, Kurvan eveha karmani jijivishekshatam samaha, evam tvaye nanyate tostina karma lipitenare, means that once we have that directive that everything should be done for Krishna, whatever stage of life we're in, when we begin it, we'll make progress, and that progress is never lost. So this is important verse to meditate on. There's no alternative to this way for man to keep this conception. What else? Do we have the microphones floating around? And by the way, could we pull out? I'm sorry. Okay. There's some zafus in there. Can we pull out the zafus? Thank you, Deepa.
Next, chapter 18, verses 5 through 9.
He says, such activities are recommended in the Bhagavad Gita. What activities? When altruistic activities are executed in the spirit of Shishupanishad, they become karma yoga. So on page 706 of the Bhagavad Gita, text number 5, chapter 18, yajna dana tapa karma na tyajan karyam evatat yajna danam tapaschaiva pavanani manishinam. Acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance are not to be given up. They must be performed. Indeed, sacrifice, charity, and penance purify even the great souls. Text number 6. Etanyapi tu karmani sangam tyakva palani cha kartavya niti me parta nishchitam matam uttamam. All these activities should be performed without attachment or any expectation of result. They should be performed as a matter of duty, O Sanapritta. That is my final opinion. Niyatasya tu sannyasa karmano nopapadyate. Mohat tasya parityagas tamasa parikirtitaha. Prescribed duties should never be renounced. If one gives up his prescribed duties because of illusion, such renunciation is said to be in the mode of ignorance. Dukam ityeva yat karma kaya klesha payat tyajet sakritva rajasam tyagam naiva tyaga palam labhet. Anyone who gives up prescribed duties as troublesome or out of fear of bodily discomfort is said to have renounced in the mode of passion. Such action never leads to the elevation of renunciation. And finally, number 9, karyam ityeva yat karma niyatam kriyatirjuna sangam tyakva palam chaiva sityaga satvikomataha. O Arjuna, when one performs his prescribed duty only because it ought to be done, and renounces all material association and all attachment to the fruit, his renunciation is said to be in the mode of goodness. Prabhupada gives the example of finding a $100 bill. Actually, I think when he gave the example, it was a 100-rupee note. And he said that there's three ways that you can react to it. One way is that You can pick it up and keep it. But then he said, you'll be thinking, I took somebody else's loss. And if someone lost it, it belonged to somebody else, but I'm spending it for myself. Yeah. Yeah, we used to have a saying in America, finders, keepers, losers, weepers. So that's one way. That's material life. We're taking and using the resources that are here and not considering whose they are. And there's great anxiety there. And there's also the resultant karma that comes from that. It's bondage. It binds me to the material world. Second way I can react to the $100 bills, just don't touch it. Just leave it alone. And that's also imperfect because it has an owner. And leaving it doesn't give me any ultimate peace, and it doesn't solve the problem of the person who lost it. So the best mode of action is to pick it up and find the owner and give it back. It's especially a more clear example, I think, is if you see somebody drop a $100 bill. If you saw it happen and then you pick it up, then you really feel guilty. If you just leave it and you knew where it was supposed to go, then you'd also feel bad. But if you give it back, then there's a completion of the action. So the idea of these three kinds of activity that are mentioned in the verse are karma, akarma, and vikarma. And karma means regulated activities according to the prescribed duties of the shastra. And vikarma means activities which are against shastra, which cause me severe reaction. And akarma means work that's non-reactive. And that's what's being specifically advocated here in the Ishavasya spirit. Don't become attached to the fruit of your work, as you're obligated, because you're going to have to go on working anyway. You can't just stop the momentum of your work. But don't be attached to the fruits. In another place, Krishna says, dhunena hyavaram karma. That's keep it far away. Keep the mentality of being attached to the fruits of your work very far away from you. But work. Work as you're obligated, but don't be attached to the fruits of your work. And from that, naturally, you'll come to knowledge. And this is a beginning stage in yoga, this karma yoga, working as you're obligated and giving away the fruits. You want to say more about the verses?
Now, while you were speaking, I was thinking, this would be if you're working for God without attachment, but there's not a lot of devotion, then that would be nishkama karma yoga. And if you're working spontaneously for God out of devotion, then that's bhakti yoga. So it kind of, karma yoga and bhakti yoga in one sense are non-different. But in these verses in the 18th chapter, Krishna's speaking about nishkama karma yoga, where one is working without attachment. He's doing his duty because he knows it ought to be done, and there's no attachment. And then I was reading today, I read the third chapter, which is titled Karma Yoga, and there Krishna explains also how if you're not offering the fruits of your results to the Supreme, then you become bound. Yagnartha karmano nyatra loko yam karma bandana tardartam kamakunteya
Mukta-sangas
matra. If one does offer the fruits to the Supreme, then he becomes freed from those reactions. And then, so Krishna is speaking all through the chapter about how one should work without attachment, and how one should offer everything to the Supreme. And then at one point, about in the middle, after about two-thirds of the way through, Krishna starts talking about those who are fixed in the self and self-realized, and who They're not motivated outwardly by anything. They're already self-satisfied. And Krishna says for them, there's no duty to be performed. But still they perform their duty, and they act without attachment to set an example for others. And they're also outwardly working for the Supreme. So whether you're attached or unattached, or realized or unrealized, everyone should offer everything to work in the spirit of Isha Vasha. Right? Right.
What else? Yes.
So, I was just thinking, like, whenever we are doing karma, and, you know, this just some 3-4 days back, I had this meditation that whenever we are doing any karma, it's like, we are reaching out to the Lord, and it's always a choice, and it's every karma, it's a choice between what Duryodhana and Arjuna had. Either to take shelter at lotus feet of Lord Krishna, or to use the material energies, that is the army, or the other of Krishna. And we tend to choose the other side, which is the seemingly army of Krishna, or the material energy, rather than the lotus feet of the Krishna. So whenever we are doing any activity, if we are surrendering ourselves, then the benefit is more associated, being on Krishna's side with meditation on Krishna, rather than the energies of Krishna, that will help in quick deliverance. So I confuse this.
Is it a question?
So I was not sure whether I was very clear on what I was saying.
Well, let me, from what you just said, reflect back my realization of what you said, and that was that if you surrender to Krishna, your life becomes much easier, and the result is sure and certain. And if you don't, then you're on your own. The material world means anything can happen, and you're on your own. It's a dangerous place, actually. There may be a sign outside the material world, I'm not sure, but I don't remember. It says, enter at your own risk. And when you come in, really, you're taking your own responsibility. And we're not equipped for that, because we're not the controllers. So it's a great relief, actually, to surrender to Krishna. And it doesn't happen immediately because, as Prabhupada mentioned in this purport, I'm accustomed to taking the armies of Duryodhan, or of Krishna, rather than Krishna himself. I'm thinking that this will, be a good protection for me. Atmasainye sosatsapi. Srimad Bhagavatam calls these fallible soldiers. That deha patra kalatradi. Welcome. Deha patra kalatra deshu atmasaini susatsapi tesham pramato nidhanam pashana pina pashyati. He describes the body and all of the things that go along with the body as our fallible soldiers. And they take shelter of the body and think it will protect me, or that my family will protect me. It won't. Tesham pramato nidhanam pashana pina pashyati. And even though I see repeatedly that it doesn't, I see but I don't see. So hearing about how Krishna gives protection to his devotees, and actually practicing surrendering, engaging in the process of surrender, and seeing how Krishna actually is there to protect me as I surrender, it's like in any relationship, isn't it? In a relationship, when you first meet somebody, maybe it's a business relationship or maybe it's a personal relationship, but people are a little guarded at first when they first meet. It's like, okay, we'll see. You don't reveal your mind all at once to somebody when you first meet them, because, what if actually, they were sent by your enemy, or there may be so many ideas about how this person might not reciprocate properly. But over time, I begin to see that someone is trustworthy, and then the relationship becomes closer, more intimate, and then I'm willing to surrender, you know. And so it's the same thing with our relationship with Krishna. And as I develop my relationship with Krishna, it goes both ways also. I'm developing my faith in Krishna, and he's developing his faith in me. I mean, why should it just be like, well, why should I have faith in God? Why should I have faith in you? You're also an individual. Are you faith-worthy? You know, what have you done? And someone who's in a relationship who's very steady all the time and always shows up when they say they're going to show up and they do what they say they're going to do, that type of person engenders faith and trust. So take some time, but it's sweet surrender, because actually, I was thinking of this, actually even today, I was just thinking how, boy, you know, if you have to redesign like a room or something, like say a kitchen, and you have to figure out all the different parts that go into it, it's endless work. And, you know, like any one building that you have to live in this world, it's put together with thousands of nails and boards and all kinds of paint and everything like that. So much work goes into just living in this world, and so much consideration of every step that I take. It's the world of doubt, actually, the material world. Are both of you comfortable? Would you like to sit up closer? Okay. Okay. Thank you for coming. Hare Krishna. Make sure that, even if you're here for a few minutes, please be comfortable. what was I saying? Huh? Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it's the world of doubt. I move with trepidation in this world, because anything can happen, and I'm not sure, I'm not certain of who my friends are, who my enemies are in the material world. It's the world of darkness. This is what it means, the world of darkness. And in the spiritual world, it's home. It's described in the Bhagavatam. It's like a weary traveler being on the road for a long time, coming home. You know what that's like, anybody who travels. When you're at home, you get what you want. When you travel, you get what you get. And so a weary traveler coming home, and it also means that there's full trust. I've given this example before. You know, when you come home, and someone gives you something to eat, for instance, you don't ask them what's in it. Like if I go to, a friend's house. If we all go to Hansapriya's house and she brings us something to eat, we don't say, "Hey, Hansapriya, what's in this?" Because we know that she loves us, and you know she's gonna, and she's a devotee, so she's gonna cook something that's good for us, and that, you know. But if I go somewhere else and I never met the person, I'll sit down and it's like, "Wait a minute." What's in this? You know, I'm very careful, and the material world's like that. You know, it's a place where I'm being careful at every step that I take, of what's in this, because I don't know at every step what's in it. But in the spiritual world, there's complete freedom. It's the world of faith, because there's no there's nothing holding me back. I'm free to move, and the more we have this knowledge out of our relationship with Krishna, that I'm free to move, I'm free to surrender. Boy, is that exciting. The life of sweet surrender, that you mean I can completely surrender to Krishna? Like Prabhupada said once that if, you know, how hard is material life on a scale of 1 to 10? 10 being like practically unbearable. Well, 9 being practically unbearable and 10 being completely unbearable. How is material life? You tell me. It's a 10? 11. Okay, so now what if a guy drives up tonight in a in a car, and he walks in with his briefcase and he says, all right, everybody, I'm going to take care of your affairs. Who in here, you know, I have the means, and I'm just going to take whatever you have going on in your life that's difficult, anything, don't worry about it. Insurance, cover it, medical, you know, expenses, whatever problems you have, I'll sort them out. Do you have mental problems? I'll deal with that too. I'll just deal with everything. Is that okay? How would you feel when you're at a, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10? You know, there's some relief, right? It's like, I'll take care of your affairs. Of course, then you might think, well, you know, can he really do it? But when Krishna says, Sarva Dharman Paritya Ja Mame Kam Sharadam Braja Aham Tvam Sarva Papi Mocha Isami Masuchaha, he says, don't worry, I'll take care of your affairs. Just surrender to me. That's an interesting proposition for having entered into a world that's held together by millions of nails and boards and paint and all the things that you have to do just to step forward in life. So much anxiety at every second. Someone of Krishna's stature, who is he? Ishavasa, the Isha. He's the supreme controller. Now he says it. Surrender to me and I'll take care of all your affairs. Don't worry. Don't fear and don't hesitate. I remember reading that. The first Back to Godhead magazine I got, it had this article by Prabhupada and it was the verse. So Sarva Dharman Pariyaja. And I remember Masuchaha is mentioned in there. It says, don't worry. Don't fear, don't worry, don't hesitate. Just surrender. So, yes.
One difficulty I see here is that, first of all, we don't know what is a surrender there. And at what point Krishna
first of all, you don't know what?
What is a surrender with respect to that verse?
What is surrender?
What is a surrender? And then... even if we somehow surrender...
Wait, well, that's one. You have two, right? So yes. Let me deal with one first. Thank you for coming.
You.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I know, but... And find out where they're from.
Just let me rephrase
okay,
that.
Okay.
So one thing is we don't know at what point we can consider ourselves... as surrendered souls, because it's not a black and white, it's a continuous process.
Yeah, so let me first say, the first question was, you know, what is surrender, right? So surrender means, first of all, accepting things which are favorable for devotional service, anukul. This is the definition of devotion, of pure devotional service. It should be anukul, it means favorable. So you have to find out what's favorable for Krishna. And so there are instructions about that, about what's favorable. The, you know, they can do a silent bell during the class. So anukul means favorable, a favorable kind of activities. So you find out what's favorable and then perform activities which are favorable for Krishna, accepting things that are favorable for Krishna's service. So that's one part of surrender. Another thing is rejecting things which are unfavorable. So as human beings, we have this discriminatory power, and that is to accept some things and reject other things. And so those are two categories. You comb through the scripture, you hear from the authorities about what's favorable and then what's unfavorable, and then make a list. I'll accept this, I'll reject that. That's surrender. Because you're actually doing it. You're the chooser in this case. Or as George Bush you said, the decider is the decider. So then then there's considering Krishna to be your maintainer. Now, this requires introspection. If you look around and see how other living beings are being maintained, you can come to this conclusion. In fact, Jesus Christ, he gave some instruction like this to his disciples, and he said, look out and watch the birds and see how they're maintained. Now, do they have any problems? Not really. The birds in my yard don't have any problems at all. They got this huge tree, a pittosporum tree. I can watch them through my kitchen window. And they're billions of, you couldn't count the berries on there. Even if you hired the whole Stanford campus, they couldn't count as how many berries are on that tree. And all they do, the birds, they wake up and they go get them. And they already have a beak that is made custom to crack them open. And there's must be some little fruit in there or seed that they like. And they just eat it. No problem at all. And I'm not even going to get into the squirrels on this one. But the squirrels, no, I won't go there. Okay, so the birds, they're maintained. So then you look around and you see, like, why wouldn't I be maintained? And so one should consider Krishna one's maintainer and one's protector. And that's similar kind of thing. That take protection from Krishna. Don't take protection from my own endeavor, as I gave the verse, Deha Patra Kalatradishu. Realize that I'm fallible. You know, you can lie on the ground and hear yourself breathe and the lungs going in and out and understand how the body's a machine. It's chugging along without any help from you. And really, you can't protect yourself. I had this realization with my elderly parents before they passed away. I used to go over and help them do things, and they lived in the same house for as long as I was alive, and they had this attic where they'd pull down the stairway, and then they'd climb up into the attic. And when they were in their late 80s, and my mom in her 90s, she was climbing up this rickety stairway to go up in the attic. And I remember one day watching her go up there, and I was thinking, what are you doing? You can't do this. Don't go up there. And then I realized when I was driving home, she's been doing it for 90 years without any help from me. And, you know, she survived. And so, I mean, just be introspective and see who's maintaining, who's actually protecting. Mari Krishna Rakhe Ke, Rakhe Krishna Mari Ke. If Krishna wants to protect you, then who can harm you? And if Krishna wants to harm you, then who can protect you? Prabhupada once said that his father used to say that when Krishna takes from you, he takes with 10 hands. And when he wants to give to you, he gives with 10 hands. When he wants to take away everything, you can't stop it. And when he wants to give to you, you'll get so much you won't know what to do with it. But in either case, it's not you doing it. Observe. Watch that and see. And also, surrender means to be meek and humble. Why not? You know, be meek and humble. It actually works in all circumstances because that's our constitutional nature is that we're tiny. And if we adhere to that nature, then life becomes actually expansive and our knowledge expands. In fact, that's why Krishna says in the 13th chapter, Amanitvam Adamvitvam, the first two items of knowledge, the process of knowledge, are humility and pridelessness. So humility and pridelessness, Amanitvam Adamvitvam. So humility is first. And the analogy, take a gigantic positive magnet and put next to it a tiny positive magnet, and what will happen? The tiny positive magnet will get thrown to the other side of the universe. On the other side, that little tiny magnet, if it's negative and it's on the other side of the universe, and you put a gigantic, inconceivably large positive magnet, that little magnet will be drawn to it automatically, just like that, without practically any extra endeavor. It's natural. So if we're meek and humble, then naturally we'll become attracted to Krishna and we'll be lined up with him. That's the process of surrender. So now that's the first question. Now you know what it is. Now all you have to do is do it. And what was the second one? You know, how will you know when you're surrendered? It's a good question. But one thing is that this process is experienced directly. Pratyakshavagamam tarmyam. Therefore, Krishna says, the perfection of religion. What is religion? Religio. It means to link together. It's the same word that comes from ligament, how to connect something. So when you're connected, you actually know it for yourself. You don't have to ask for a certificate. You'll feel it. When you surrender and when you're performing service, you'll feel for yourself. Krishna will reveal himself to you. Bhakti Parishanu Bhavu Virakti Ranyata Traisha Trika Eka Kala means that three things will happen spontaneously and simultaneously, and that is that you'll feel your bhakti increasing. And you'll see Krishna for yourself directly. You'll see him. And you'll feel detached from all other things. In the same way as a person who's hungry and who eats food simultaneously feels nourishment, satisfaction, and eradication of hunger, all those things go away. So you'll, when you're engaged in the surrender process, you actually feel these reciprocations from Krishna, and you'll see it. Yes.
Seeing of Krishna means what?
What does seeing Krishna mean? Well, first of all, we will see Krishna by hearing him. The first place we see Krishna actually is not with our eyes, but with our ears, and we will hear the sound vibration, and it awakens us. Prabhupada describes in one place that, for instance, hearing the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra means that we'll experience it to be unlike any other kind of sound we've ever heard, and we'll recognize that it. Even if we don't know exactly what it is, we'll recognize that it's not from this creation. It's a different thing altogether. And also, there's a sense of seeing Krishna, as he says in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in all of his energies. We'll be aware that even if we don't see the form of Shyamasundara, for instance, we'll become very much aware of the fact that Krishna as the Isha, the Supreme Controller, is moving everything. And we'll see him. Rasoham apsakonteya prabhasmi shashishuryayo pranavak sarvavedeshu shabdake purusham rishu. See, that's a good example of how we should be. Shyamasundara was just now. He walked in, his mother left him for like 30 seconds, and he started crying. And you should feel like that. I should feel like that when I'm separated from chanting the holy name for 30 seconds. You should be like, wah. When you feel like that, then you know you're making advancement. Prashad? Prashad is your name?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, is separation created so that we can feel for him, or how is that?
Pardon me?
Is that process of separation created? This is what I'm saying is, even the separation has to be created, right?
The feeling of separation?
That's true. We got separated from Lord. So has it been done deliberately by Lord so that we can feel for it? That's when like, we come close? Because it is like the... Only when you separate, like, and you feel the love, right? If you're always there, then the love is not probably...
So say it as a one sentence as a question. What's the question?
It's a question. Question is like, is that separation process created by Lord? Is it his leela like in that we have to separate it from him so that we tend to love him back? Or is it like in my own creation that I...
You mean like why I'm in the material world separated from him?
Yeah.
Generally not. It's generally we take it that it's my fault. First of all, we're never really separated from the Lord because we're part and parcel of the Lord. But due to our consciousness, we become covered and we're forgetful that actually, we're connected to the Lord. This is called Maya, or that which is not. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Icha dvesha samutena dvandva mohena bharata sarva bhutani samoham sargi yanti parantapa. He said that living beings who are covered by the material world are affected by desire and hatred. And there's a kind of aversion that's described, aversion that I have for the Lord. So this kind of causeless aversion that I have for the Supreme Lord is the cause of my separation. It's not that the Lord wants to be separated from us or is, but we're in ignorance. Ignorance also means ignorance. I'm ignoring. I've turned the other way. So the process of waking up means turning back towards Krishna and remembering our eternal relationship with him. Our ignorance is considered to be beginningless. and now we're waking up to our eternal relationship with Krishna.
So eternally, initially if we were with Lord, right, how did we even have that, we talk about Vaikuntha where there is no anxiety.
Somehow or other we've fallen into this material nature. And, you know, Shankaracharya once said that, or maybe it was the Buddha, I can't remember, but if you're shot with an arrow, your first order of business is to get the arrow out. It's not to, like, find out who shot it exactly, you know. So, Chaitanya, in the Shikshashka, somehow or other, I've fallen into this material nature. It's from an immemorial time. So we take it that, you know, our business is to reconnect with Krishna, and somehow or other I've turned my face. Yeah, sure.
No, but logically it looks more like a leela of Lord than because you look at the number of creatures outside. You have billions and billions of creatures, so it's hard to imagine that billions of creatures had that whatever, and they fell down here. Than to believe like, and it's Lord's leela that, you know, he wanted to have a creation and then. And then, like, you know, as an evolution or whatever, someone comes close to him. That seems more logical to understand. It may not be right, but at least logical to understand.
Seems more logical? Yeah, that what?
That it's Lord's Leela that, you know, that he created something like, you know, all the billions of creatures, then so many billions of creatures falling down from the spiritual planet to the material planet. That sounds a bit... I mean, if hundreds, thousands...
Then you can take it like
billions
that.
Billions is like...
Then you can take it from that side. As I said, somehow or other. So you can see it as somehow some kind of leela. It is the Lord's leela, actually. It's called the Srishti leela. When the Lord creates the material world, he's breathing out, and all the souls who were within his body get re-emanated and reanimated once they come out into the material nature. So in a sense, that is his leela. And then the most exciting part, actually, Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes that the most glorious of all of Krishna's leelas is saving the souls from that ignorance, bringing them back out again. So yeah, you can take it like that. It's part of the Lord's leela, saving us from the material world. Yes, Gadai. Is that okay? Question or comment?
Some people say that separation is the worst than grouping, because if you separate from the Lord and like ignore the Lord, he's starting to feel a little, you know, sad, right? He feels sad that you're ignoring him. So then you're turning your back. But if you group back with him, you turn back, you group with the devotees, then it's like a karma, right? Is that right? A karma?
Yeah. A karma would be meaning that your activities are all dedicated towards Krishna.
And so if someone would continuously, you know, ignore it, what would happen to him at the end?
If someone continuously ignores?
Yes, even though he has all the books, he just ignores it.
How is it that he has all the books how did he get all the books?
Everyone distributed to him, and he reads them, but he doesn't.
Well, when he bought the book, did he think about Krishna for that 1 second?
Yes.
Okay, then in that case, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Neha bikramanashosti pratyavayana vidyate swalpamapyasya dharmasya trayate mahatobaya. And that is that even if one thinks of him or does something favorable towards his service, even for su-alpa, means just a tiny fraction of a second, then that progress he made won't be lost. and that will help him in the future. It's called Agyata Sukriti. It's a kind of spiritual wealth that somebody gets by acting in a devotional way, even if they don't know it at first. And then that accumulates, and that gives them an impetus to take to Krishna's service later, maybe in another lifetime, or later in this lifetime.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Hare Rama. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. This is a comment. I heard that when we fall from the spiritual world and want to enjoy our material senses, the first thing that, first stop is Brahma. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I heard that too.
Good.
Yeah, it means you can, the nature of the material world is gradually being affected by the modes of nature. You can come to any level of degradation or elevation according to which mode you associate with. Purusha prakriti stohi bhunte prakriti jan gunan karanam guna sangosya sadasad yoni janmasu. That the cause of our up and down situations in the material world, whether we're Brahma or a tiny little germ, it comes from our association with the three modes of material nature. So the question, the most pressing question is, from the position I'm in now, how do I utilize that knowledge to elevate myself? Now, once somebody becomes elevated to a situation where, as a soul, he can see beyond the mind, the senses, and the intelligence, then one can clearly understand what one's eternal situation is. From within the realm of my own mind and senses and intelligence, trying to logically deduce the and figure out the conundrum of how did I get into this situation in the first place, I've seen in my short lifetime that is not resolved from a mental platform, because I've seen experts on both sides present ideas of, you know, this and that. And it's not satisfactory. But what is satisfactory is if I have my own experience. For instance, if you take to the process very sincerely, follow the regulative principles very carefully. That means that you're creating a dry field that can catch fire very easily. You're not pouring any more water. You're not associating with the three modes of material nature in any conscious or significant way. Three, four regulative principles means no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, no meat eating. So these things create a dry field. Then take to the process of chanting the names of Krishna with full concentration as a dedication, a dedicated life of hearing the Lord's names. By doing that, you'll see for yourself. Pratyakshavagamam dharmyam. You'll see your own existential situation. You can see the soul. You can see yourself as a soul beyond the senses and the mind and the intelligence. And that's necessary. You have to see it for yourself. It's not a philosophical... The philosophy will help you to some degree, but you have to take it and you have to apply it and have your own experience. That's the best evidence. You'll see for yourself. Because Tarko Pratishtanat, through argument, there's no standing. Vedanta Sutra says, through argument, you won't come to the conclusion, because somebody else will come and overturn your argument. That's the realm of logic. Tarko Pratishtanat. There's no standing in that. So don't be a tarki. Be an experiencer. Take the process. Sometimes you need to know how a light turns on. And other times you just need to flip the switch. You know, if it works, just go work it. Turn it on. Life, you know, this is partly our teaching in Kali Yuga. Things are, life is very short. Therefore, we've been given a shortcut process, this chanting process. So take it. See for yourself. Experience. Surrender. Actually perform this experiment on yourself. There's no one else you can do it on. You can't get anyone else to surrender. People have tried. I mean, you can get them to surrender for a while. You can subdue them through force or through you know, some kind of argument or whatever, but it'll spring back. A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, and you can lead a man to wisdom, but you can't make him think. But you can do it on yourself. You can decide to surrender and take the Krishna's words in the Bhagavad Gita as your directive and go through the process. And Prabhupada lays it out here in the Shrishta Upanishad. He says, if you want to live this kind of life, the Shastra is all there. The instructions there. The help will come to you automatically. It's miraculous, actually. And someone who's living in this kind of lifestyle and has experienced how Krishna is giving with 10 hands knows directly. And there's no end to surrender. It's not a plateau that one comes to and says, now I'm surrendered. But it's an eternal, a nectarian process, actually, surrendering. The more one surrenders, the more one wants to surrender. Now let's hear from the Ramayana, because we're on a marathon to finish the Ramayana before Ram Navami, which is coming up on the 24th. And I took the liberty of starting already, just to help us along. I thought maybe if I could come in here on some days, if I could set up the camera, I'll just sit in here and read all day, and then I can broadcast it. And if you're at work, huh? It's not working. Where's Nilesh? Jeez.
What is that up there?
That's our Jumbotron.
What is that?
See, the projector projects budgeons on things like that. Kishore told me he's going to demonstrate tonight how well it works. So nothing's coming through. Yes, Sonny. Sure. Use the microphone, because there's somebody in the... at least we're broadcasting as far as the kitchen goes.
Prabhuji, even if we completely surrendered and leaving with the rules and regulations, following the rules and regulations, is sometimes the mind, as a being, as a being in this material world, that we may go to one mode to another mode, means in the goodness and passion and ignorance, sometimes you passing through in different areas, not just saying in the goodness itself, sometimes, you know, in a passionate way because of the material life what we are going through now. So not only that, even if you are initiated such a long time and you are raising up in a higher level in the spiritual sky, sometimes you may fall down too. And what is that phenomenon? Why it is happening?
Well, first of all, we have to examine your premise. You know, about falling down from the spiritual sky. Once one rises up, you said, then one can still fall down from the spiritual sky. The only thing that's mentioned where one's obligated, or the tendency to fall down from the spiritual sky that's mentioned in the Bhagavatam, is that one has not reawakened one's original relationship with Krishna. This is stated by the demigods when they were praying to Lord Krishna within the womb, and they said, Yene ravindaksha vimuktavaninas tvayasta bhava ravashuda pudaya aruya krishna paramparam tata patantyato nadrita yushmanangraya. That that someone who has attained a kind of liberation, which doesn't involve reawakening their original personal relationship with Krishna, is an imagined kind of liberation. And due to the lack of rasa, a relationship with Krishna, that person will hanker again for the three modes of material nature, even if that person has come to the level of Brahman, or which is slightly situated above the modes. The tendency of the soul is to want relationship and variety, and will seek that. And if it's not found in the spiritual world, which is the original source of all variety, then one will go for the reflection of the material world and fall back down again. There are statements that if one is very advanced in devotional service by making an aparadha, a Vaishnava aparadha, for instance, an offense towards an advanced devotee, that one may suffer the effects of that and fall down from an exalted position that one's attained. We have the story of Bharat Maharaj in the Srimad Bhagavatam, who is at the stage of bhava, which is a very advanced stage of devotional service. And he became distracted in his practice by a deer and took the body of a deer in his next life. But then he progressed and came to the perfectional stage. In the beginning stage of devotional service, it's altogether possible and practically probable that we may experience some ups and downs. This is actually charted out for us in the description of our progress given by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Ato shraddha tata sada sangata bhajana kriya tato narta nivritti satato nishta ruchistata. He gives a line of progress which involves the thickening of one's shraddha or faith. And in the beginning, faith awakens because of jnata sukriti, because of our unknown connection with devotees who give out devotional service and who walk about the world. We due to that contact, we get an accumulation of this sukriti, bhakti unmukhi sukriti, a kind of wealth that is given out by devotees. And then when that accumulates in our heart, then shraddha is born. Shraddha means where you place your heart. Shradh means heart. Dha means it's an active verb to place. So then, after we have shraddha, he says, then we seek devotee association. Adau means in the beginning. Adau shraddha tata sadhu sangha. Then after that, we want sadhu sangha. So that's why some people want sadhu sangha, is because they have shraddha. So we search out association with devotees. It's natural. First thing, when someone has faith, they say, where are the devotees? I want to see them. I want to be with them. Then when you're with the devotees, then you say, I want to be like them. So then what do you get? You get bhajana kriya. Or there's, as you said, rules and regulations. There's a process to follow. And that's true in any organization or any kind of system. When you go in, then you say, okay, now what do I do? And they say, do this. So the Nectar of Devotion tells you, what are the 64 activities of devotional service? You can follow them. What are the 5 most important activities of devotional service? What are the best ways to follow those? So the bhajana kriya means that, you know, when you enter into it, you say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to follow what it is. I'm going to take the process. Then, you'll, as you mentioned, there's initiation. Initiation means you're officially beginning, right? You go into the class, you say, I'm starting now. I'm taking a vow. I'm taking initiation from a spiritual master that I'm going to do this. I'm going to follow the process. Then comes some hard work. After sadhu sangha, bhajana kriya, anartha nivritti means now, just like when we walked in the temple. See, Satyadev Prabhu is in the mode of goodness, so wherever he goes, he tries to make the place cleaner. I know, because I travel with him all the time. As soon as we get there, he's like, let's clean this place. So when he walked in the temple tonight, it looked perfectly fine, but he said, I'm going to clean the temple. So he started sweeping. And I thought, well, it looks fine. And then I saw a big pile of pile of dust and all kinds of stuff that he took out with his bare hands. He cleaned it. So you might start the process and you think, Yeah, I look pretty good. I'm in pretty good shape. I have faith. I have association. I've got the process. And now, what do you got? A big pile keeps showing up every time you sweep. No matter how many times you sweep, this is anarta nivritti. You know, you don't know until you actually take a stand how many things you have lurking. You know, until you decide to clean your house, you don't know. You don't even remember how much stuff you stored in the attic in the basement. No idea. There's so much stuff in there. It'll take you months to get rid of it all. And same thing. We've accumulated so much in our sojourn in the material world of unwanted things. And when we take a stand and we say, I'm doing this, I'm going to clean it now. I'm no more procrastinating. Not another life. I'm doing it now. That's initiation. Finished. Clearing the account. Whatever it takes, I'm going to do it. Now you start cleaning the house. And it gets dirtier and dirtier. Another example is like making ghee. You take one thing, butter, and you heat it up. All the impurities start coming out. Over and over again, you scrape it off, and more come out. So that's anarta nivritti. And in that coming to the stage of nishta, there's also anishta. Nishta means steadiness, where you actually, now you have some standing. There's no more rocking caused by the mind. It's funny, if you actually concentrate, like this morning I was watching very carefully when I was chanting my japa, what was flying past in my mind. And it's almost like a jet stream, I notice it. It almost knocks my head to one side, some of these thoughts that come in. They're not bad thoughts, they're usually things about my service. But I'll be sitting chanting and all of a sudden, you forgot to write such and such, you know. He probably hates you now. And it's like, no. And a jet stream goes by my head, and I almost feel like going, wow, you know. And I'm like, where'd that come from? And then from, you can sit for two more seconds, and a jet stream will come from the other direction. And those, well, there are forces that are coming on a subtle level, on a gross level. There are all kinds of things that when we settle down in devotional service, we actually get a standing nishta. And those things don't knock us, but we become solidly situated in devotional service. We get a standing. But before we come to that stage, we're anishta, which means unsteady. And there's a list, there's a categorical description of each one of the stages of unsteadiness. For instance, one of the first things listed by Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, when one takes to devotional service, is an immaturity in which one thinks that I know everything and that I'm very advanced. That's the first symptom of a person entering legitimately into the unsteady position of devotional service, that I really got this down, I know everything, I'm a very advanced person just by starting. And then there are other symptoms of not being able to keep vows. And there are a multitude of ways that I can become disturbed by my senses. One day I'm sense controlled, next day I'm not. So that's described, that's part of the process. And as we go through that process, we come to the other side, just like you do in anything. And when you come out the other side and you become steady, then you're eligible to move on to other stages, like ruchi, where you actually have taste, a positive taste, and then attraction, and bhava, where the actual original emotion that we have for Krishna begins to manifest in a profound way, and Krishna prema. So the goal, as Prabhupada writes in the light of the Bhagavad, is sure and certain. We should have no doubt about the result, the end result. And while we're in the process, we should also have no doubt that we're going to have difficulties and struggles. But once we decide to do it, we're going through no matter what. There's no turning back. And sometimes devotees do decide to turn back. But it doesn't mean that Krishna's going to let them. In fact, he mentions this, that Krishna says, that person may be a fool, but I'm not a fool. Why should I, after they've already decided to surrender to me, why should I give them a situation where they can actually completely forget me? those who have at once tasted the nectar of devotional service, even if they try to forget, they won't be successful. Ultimately, they'll come back. That's due to sensual disturbance, things like that. Aparad, or offenses towards devotees, may be more severe. And for a longer period of time, we may experience separation from the devotees and from the process of devotional service. Maybe for some lifetimes. And maybe we'll even come close to the devotees, but we can't quite take the process of devotional service. Something's holding me back. I can't do it due to some previous offense. Different kinds of forces may do that. But the result is sure and certain. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, for one who does good, he's never overcome by evil. And even a little advancement on this path will protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. So don't worry. Take the process with full certainty. And Krishna wants us to come back to Godhead. And he will give us all help and intelligence and facility. Sometimes it may look retrograde, like we're going the wrong way. But that's also described like when you're on a path, say you're going to climb to the Himalayas and you're going to the highest peak, you have to go through the foothills first. And they're up and down like this before you actually climb up and you get to the base camp where you're going to climb the mountain. But you're still making progress. Is that all right? You fully determined? I said, are you fully determined? Okay, good. Yes.
Regarding the Vaishnava aparads, when the devotees are neophyte devotees, it's hard for them to know what is a Vaishnava aparad versus what is not. So they may commit some Vaishnava aparads not knowing, mainly because of ignorance. That is one question. In that case, does Krishna take those offenses seriously? That's one question.
Don't go to two questions. when you commit an aparad, see, a lot of it has to do with intention, just like in the law. You've heard me say this a million times in class already, but in the law, if you intended to kill somebody, you're going to maybe get the death penalty, special circumstances. If you accidentally did it, there's a lot of leniency there. And really, Vaishnava aparada has a lot to do with the mood and how you deal with devotees. And the other thing is, don't remain ignorant, become educated. Like this Saturday, we're having a special class on Saturday morning. Part of it will be Malini will be presenting an ongoing series that we're having here on Vaishnava etiquette. Of how to deal with different kinds of Vaishnavas, how to deal with Vaishnavas in general. For instance, did you know if you're worshiping, this is in Shastra, if you're worshiping the deity and an advanced Vaishnav comes, it's not an offense to stop your deity worship and go and greet the Vaishnav. In fact, it is an offense if you don't do that. Because, why do you think we're practicing Vaishnavism? We worship Vaishnavas because that's where Krishna is in their heart, love of Krishna. So first of all, don't remain ignorant, understand how to work, because then when you develop this understanding of how to treat devotees, for that matter, how to treat all living entities, you don't want to make offenses to any living entity. Be very careful how you move in the world. This is an advanced stage of devotional service. It's the middle stage, the beginning stage, the neophyte stage. One's not clear about, one knows that Krishna is there in the temple, has a clear idea of that. Acharam eva hare pujam ya sharehe te. Natad bhakteshu chanyeshu sabhakta prakritya smitahai. He's a materialistic devotee, which is kind of a misnomer. But still, he's considered to be a devotee because he has faith in the deity. But for others, Nachat bhakteshu, for bhaktas, and cha anyeshu, and for all other living entities, he doesn't know how to treat them properly. So, but a middle devotee knows how to distinguish and knows how to treat other devotees and show proper respect. And we've gone into that, and you've gone into it in your Bhakti Shastri in clear detail about verse number 5, right? Of there are different levels of devotees, and you should, you know, act accordingly in those things. And then when you're, if you're not in ignorance about it and you're very careful, then you're practicing Vaishnavism. That's part of practicing Vaishnavism is worshiping Vaishnavas and learning how to, you know, treat Vaishnavas properly. Then you won't have any problem. And so if someone's brand new, they're a neophyte or the beginning, and they accidentally, you know, don't know how to address someone, or they're, you know, they make some offense or something unknowingly, it's not as severe. It takes some kind of malice or intention to really make an aparad. First of all, Vaishnavas don't take offense because they're humble. And if you offend a Vaishnav, they'll just say, yeah, no problem. And it's not the Vaishnav that you have a problem with, it's the dhulis. It's the personified foot dust of the Vaishnavas that become revengeful or vengeful. And you know. And what was the second part?
Second question is, if an advanced devotee makes an offense, offenses are taken very seriously in that case, and he may actually fall down to again back to the material platform. So the question is, why does Krishna create such a situation that an advanced devotee makes an offense and then he just keeps watching him while he falls down?
Well, sometimes it's for the example of others. Generally, an advanced devotee doesn't make an offense. But if it appears that he made an offense, like Chitraketu is a good example. Chitraketu was flying over in his airplane, and he saw Parvati sitting on the lap of Shiva. And he thought, well, that's funny. He said, why is, you know, this great supreme controller sitting, you know, having his wife sit in his lap, and there's people sitting around? He just made some comment like that. And Shiva didn't take offense at all because he knew he was just observing. But Parvati took offense. He's, who is this guy? And she made some curse, you know, that how dare you? You offended Shiva. He's a great Vaishnav. So Chitraketu, who did he become in his next life?
Vritrasura, yes.
Yeah, Vritra. And Vritra was in the body of a big demon. But actually, it's a good lesson because he was a. It showed, you know, that even in the body of a big demon, even when Indra was trying to kill him, he knew once he was killed that, you know, it would be a good situation, and Indra was afraid of him, so he kept saying, "Indra, come back and, you know, kill me. Don't be afraid. Don't run from the battlefield." And there's some beautiful prayers by Vritrasura in there. So in that situation, the devotees never vanquish. Konteya pratijani hi name bhakti pranashiti. Krishna says, Shripram bhavati dharmatma shashvashchantam nagachiti. Konteya pratijani hi name bhakti pranashiti. Declare it boldly, O Arjuna, that my devotee is never vanquished. And why did he have Arjuna declare it? Because sometimes if Krishna says something, he'll take it back or he'll reverse what he said. For the sake of a devotee, for the sake of his devotee, he may break his promise, like he did on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. He said he wouldn't fight. But to save Arjuna, he fought. So he says, declare it boldly, Arjuna, my devotee never be vanquished. It means that a devotee never is out of the purview of Krishna's protection. And if there are examples, even the example of Bharat Maharaj falling down from his situation, Sanatana Goswami tells us in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, that's done as an example for the rest of us. So we know how careful we have to be when we're practicing devotional service. He says that it was staged. He did it on purpose to show us, be careful. Don't distract your mind. It's a serious thing. As the opening line we read the other day from the Light of the Bhagavat, you were here, I think. Prabhupada said, going back to God, it is not a plaything. Don't take it to be a plaything. Become serious. You, Krishna is always protecting you. You take shelter, and there's no situation that Krishna won't rectify or save you from when you're his devotee. In fact, there's in Shastra it says, if one time someone says to Lord Ramachandra, I take complete shelter of you, then eternally after that, Lord Ramachandra is watching out for that person, making sure that no harm comes to them on the devotional level.
Can you please clarify what is this dust from the lotus feet of Vaishnavas?
Personified foot dust?
Yeah.
As mentioned in the pastime of the Kumaras, that there's the dhulis, or the foot dust of the devotee, becomes becomes angry, or that, you know, an offense was made to a devotee. It's sort of poetical in a way. I mean, of course, everything's personified in the spiritual world, so you can take it literally. Sometimes people say it's more like if somebody's followers, you know, that person might forgive you, but the followers will hate you for a long time because you offended their leader. You know, they're kind of like the dhulis, the followers of that person. Yeah, Parvati and Shiva is an example. Shiva didn't become upset, but his main follower, Parvati, became upset, and she's the one who, you know, so the people, there are people around that person you offend, and they may become upset. Hare Krishna. Deepak Ji.
Just follow up on Prabhuji's question on the offenses for devotees. I felt that, especially in India, and especially among young devotees, sorry if I'm taking the time.
No, I'm sorry.
So, there is a lot of sweet talks, which it's not that I'm detesting that or conflicting that, but Prabhu, please, give me your mercy. And so I somehow, don't get along that. So, is that an aparad to, and mentally I said, no, that's fine. You are not there, but so sometimes, I get some unnecessary emotions, whether I don't have the right humility to be in that stage to appreciate that. It's less here, but it's more among young Indian boys, devotees, actually. Yeah. Somehow me and my family are not able to, gel along.
I'm just trying to see if I can get the question. It's sometimes you see in others an obsequiousness, which means that they're like overly devotional.
Overly
like
devotional.
That.
And, overly,
and that disturb, and you look at that and it kind of disturbs you.
I'm not able to relate. Like, is it real or is it just a sweet talk?
Uh-huh.
So, Prabhu, please, help me. I want, I get mercy to go to, let's say, Mayapur Vrindavan. And I'm somehow, when I hear that, I said, so it's not that I'm challenging the blessings of Vaishnavas, but internally I'm not able to socialize or accept that, such kind of sweet talks.
Uh-huh.
Go among devotees. So is it an offense? The question was such kinds of things, if I am actually not mentally able to reconcile, is a Vaishnava offense?
Generally it's an offense if you're not happy to see other devotees. Like if you see another Vaishnava and you're not pleased to see that there's another Vaishnava in the world, then that can be an offensive mentality. In the descriptions of how to relate to other kinds of devotees, or in people in general, well, there's this for the Madhyamadikari, Ishvare Taradineshu, Balisheshu, Dusatsucha, Prema Maitri Kripopeksha, Yakaroti Samadhyamaha. There are different ways to associate with different kinds of people with different mentalities. And I was reading recently, you know, Prabhupada had his, you know, he had his God brothers, and there were some among them that he didn't wish to associate with for various reasons. And also that he didn't want his disciples to associate with. And there were others that he did want him to associate with. He was more inclined to have them associate with certain others. He made a discrimination. So a Madhyama Adhikari is someone who discriminates. In other words, he sees different categories of people and their mentalities. An Uttama Adhikari, I mean, one description of an Uttama Adhikari, there are many different angles of seeing what are lowest, middle, higher. That's all these terms mean. You know, low, middle, high, and then there's a million different combinations, permutations in between those. But one description of an Uttama Adhikari is someone who doesn't discriminate, because he just sees everyone's fully engaged in Krishna service. He doesn't see lower, higher. He just sees I'm lower, everyone's higher, and everyone's engaged. But Madhyama Adhikari, we must discriminate. So it's not bad to discriminate, but it is bad to bear any kind of malice within one's heart. It's a great art, and one should take this art. There, you'll find that there are conflicts amongst devotees all over the world, wherever you go, because there are differences of opinion. They're just living entities. They're persons, and they have a slightly different way of looking at things. And you'll find this in any religious society in the world. In fact, this is, if you study religious history, this is mostly what you're going to study about, how everyone was fighting over the little details of everything. So get used to it, first of all. Second of all, learn how to deal with that in a mature way. And if you can't appreciate someone up close, then appreciate him from far away. Back up a little and see him from way back and go like, well, they're a Vaishnav. I don't care for the way they practice, but hey, I don't have to be over there. I'm going to be over here. Therefore, you know, we should take shelter of like-minded devotees. This is one of the angas of bhakti, is to associate with devotees, and Rupa Goswami defines that. He said they should be like-minded devotees. So, you know, if someone's a little over the top and it's not something you care for, just don't develop malice in your heart. Appreciate that the fact that they're even in the game at all. And you don't have to associate with them intimately if you don't want to. Is that helpful? Okay. Acharya, Prabhu. Yes.
I want to ask a question about this regarding to Abharat and today's. We've seen that, as you say, there is some problems between devotees here, like in ISKCON and this temple, whatever. And we know, we kind of become an expert when we're trying to resolve these problems with communications, right? That helps, right? Because we may think that this guy thinks this way, but he actually just means something other way, and that helps. We communicate, and there is some, like, I remember it wasn't with Rupa Goswami, or I'm not pretty much sure, but he was seeing with his spiritual vision. He was seeing a Krishna Leela, and something happened there which was kind of funny, so he started to laugh. And at the same time, there was some person was walking, and he was disabled. He was kind of funny walking guy, and he thought that this sadhu laughs at him, and he became very angry. And immediately what happened, that I guess it was Rupa Goswami, he lost his vision of this Leela. And he started to think, what's going on? Why I don't see it anymore? And then he somehow he realized that this guy got upset because he thought that I'm laughing at him. So I wanted to ask, is there is because we've seen such misunderstanding in Shastras as a seen kind of like two types of aparadha. One is real aparadha when person wants to offend some, and other sort of it could be cleared up with just communication, but it's still there is I've never seen this type of resolving situation just with communication. I usually we've seen just cursed, you know. Like maybe if Parvati would give Chitraketu the because he wasn't, I don't feel that he was really bad person. He was wanted to offend Lord Shiva. I don't feel this way. Maybe he would, if he would explain something, it would be like communication would help. But I don't see much of such kind of result. It's just curse, and that's what I was. Is there some example in Shastra about how it could be resolved by communication?
Shivas Prabhu.
Well, coming back to like Deepak Prabhu's first, the only thing there is a very thin line between at least in the Novi stages, there is a very thin line between being obsequious and thinking oneself to be humble. The people kind of get those two concepts mixed up, and at least I can speak personally because I was born brought up in India, and it so happens in a society where obsequiousness is treated to humility and that is treated as virtue. And when we enter into devotional life, we pretty much think that we have become humble. That's it. We have achieved the humility. But it requires an expert spiritual master or a senior devotee to correct, saying that what you have is just artificial humility and it's not the actual humility. I just wanted to add that point. So so you do find devotees acting like that, over the top, being humble. The other point, if I can add about so communicating is that so Gopal Chapala offended Srivas, and then the only way he took was he communicated to Mahaprabhu that I'm suffering one way or other. You are delivering everybody. Why don't you deliver me? So resolving. That was the question, right? If I understood right, how do we resolve?
Yeah, and rather he was saying that. Most of what he's remembering from Shastra is there was an aparad, somebody took a fence at it and then hurled a curse and the person became an elephant or a crocodile, a lizard, something, you know, as a reaction to that. So he wanted to hear about how there was a mediated result that ended up okay.
We have about at least three examples in Chaitanya Bhagavat where first is Gopal Chapala's example where he went and fell at the lotus feet of Mahaprabhu, and Mahaprabhu said, you have to take shelter of Srivas and get his forgiveness. That's one. The second thing was that during the Ashtaprahariya Leela, the devotees asked, why are you not giving prema to your own mother? And then that way Mahaprabhu like resolved that issue, saying that she offended Advaita and she had to take shelter and take forgiveness. And the third thing is Devananda Pandit and how he offended Srivas. And how he took shelter of Mahaprabhu. So actually, all the aparadis in Gaur Leela.
You notice it's all in Lord Chaitanya's Leela, right? Better chance.
I'm sorry, I just spoke.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
It appears that there, you know, if we dig, there are circumstances where things worked out okay. And In our own experience, in my own experience, it's commonplace that if a person, if there's a misunderstanding that could lead to an aparad, when there's communication around it if the parties involved are sincere. They don't have a hidden motive, in other words, that it's resolved. It can be resolved. And I've seen it before. In fact, I've been involved. ISKCON actually has a mediation department. Did you know that? I think there's a couple different entities in ISKCON that are specifically for mediation. And they're used all the time because there are situations where devotees just become at odds with each other. And then, you know, one of them says, I want mediation. Or they decide to have a mediation. And then, you know, they'll have an expert come in and sit everybody down. And there's certain rules to mediation, ways that you can talk about things. And I've seen it personally. I've seen it work. I mean, I've been involved in the process. Not that I had a gripe with anybody, but I was. But it was a situation where there were you know, two groups of Vaishnavas that didn't see eye to eye, and it was causing some friction. So they needed two parties, not just the individuals involved, but they wanted a few more people. So they asked me to come. So I was on one side, and there was the other side, and then there were two mediators. Actually, what I found was the mediation was interesting. Went on for 3 days. But the best part of it was taking prasadam together. Because, you know, we were all meeting at somebody's house, and then we'd meet, and there was like three on one side, three on the other side, and two mediators, and then a bunch of cooks. And and what I found was that, you know, the devotees, when they, everyone's got to eat, so you stop the mediation, and everyone, all the, both parties who are apparently at odds with each other would sit down and have prasadam together. And then, so, well, how are you really doing? You know, I start talking, you know, and having prasadam together. And I wouldn't say that it was 100% solved, but I would say it was, you know, 80% that once those two groups of devotees saw each other at another time or heard something from another person about them, they would say, no, I actually know where this person is, how this person really feels. And you know, so it is, Prabhupada told us also that when we have disagreements, like in a temple situation, there can be disagreements among devotees, usually over service. Because what else would it be over? So that's what we're doing, right? And then someone, you know, there can be lots of disagreements about who gets to do the service or, you know, how they did the service or something like that. And some disagreement comes up. Prabhupada taught us to, he taught us the process of ishtagosi. That's one thing, come together and talk. Another thing was he taught us to come and offer obeisances to each other. Don't go away angry. This is also good for people who are married, you know. Don't go to bed angry. You know, if you have a disagreement or something like that, don't walk away from it. Mediate it. Sit down and talk about it and come to a resolution. And, you know, for Vaishnavas, we have some disagreement. We should come and offer obeisances. It, you know, it's amazing just in that one act of putting your head on the ground in front of somebody else. Namaha. You know what namaha means, right? What does it mean? It means not me. Nama, not me. You know, okay, you're putting yourself in a lower position. It's not me. And that helps. It relieves the heart. You unburden something, you know, when you put your head down on the floor. And that's really necessary to advance in devotional service. And I would argue that, you know, this is where we'll make a good percentage of our progress is how we deal with the devotees. I've always said, you know, here at our ISV, we do deity worship, but then equally important in our deity worship is how we're treating the devotees. That's advanced devotional service. In fact, Jiva Goswami says that if you're worshiping the deity expertly, but you mistreat devotees, you're like doing a fire sacrifice, but it's, you're pouring the ghee onto ashes and not onto the fire. There's no fire. Because Krishna doesn't accept it. If you offend devotees but worship him, he doesn't accept it. Madbhakta puja bhyadika, he says in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam to Uddhava, that the devotees are worshipable. And he says they're more worshipable than I am. So if someone doesn't learn the art of how to get along with devotees, even in the most extreme circumstances, then it's very difficult to please Krishna. So it's vitally important that one learn the process of if not cooperation, then mediation and agreeing to disagree. Yes, Virendra Kumar Prabhu.
Prabhuji, I would like to end the story that he said. I also heard about a devotee, that Rupa Goswami, the other devotee, the lame devotee, he felt offended because Rupa Goswami was smiling. So then Rupa Goswami lost the vision. So he then thought, what was the reason? Then he understood that it is only because of some Vaishnava prat. I must have committed some Vaishnava prat. So then he invited all the devotees of Raja and had a big feast. And this devotee, the lame devotee, also came. And then he felt satisfied in that feast and he forgave Rupa Goswami. And then is when Rupa Goswami got his spiritual vision back. So this, the point that you also said that in your meditation for 3 days, wherein devotees sat together and had prasadam, actually that is also one way of...
Good for you, Virginia. He just solved everything. No, really, because he brought the story full circle and answered it all. Very nice. So, I mean, that really does complete it because that's how we should live. You know, when we're chanting Hare Krishna, it's not just chanting Hare Krishna, it's also avoiding the 10 offenses, the first of which is to offend devotees, to make aparadas. So we should be going out of our way to take care of devotees and to make sure that we don't make offense. I mean, that's why we're very careful, even when, you know, we notice this part of the etiquette, and if you bump into somebody, immediately like... You know, I bumped into you. I'm sorry. I've seen at the airport people walking two directions and they clip each other and like they become so angry. Have you seen that? They're going in different directions. One's not watching where they're going. And, you know, the person's in anxiety. They just had a cup of coffee. They're late for their flight. Their boss just yelled at them. And they clip somebody else. And then immediately they in their heart, they just like, you idiot. Or on the freeway, it happens all the time. People scream at each other, or they feel angry, you know, because somebody cut them off. I always say that, you know, the way you can alleviate that is just imagine that it was, you know, it was sunny. You know, like you're about to yell at him, and then you realize that actually that was your friend from the temple or something like that. They go, oh, no problem, I don't mind, you know. But we should feel like that towards other living entities, not in an artificial way. It's not that we artificially go around treating everyone like our best friend or something like that, but we should carry that mentality of being careful where we go. Because also, we don't know who we're talking to. Look at the situation of Maharaj Rahugana and Judd Bharata. Maharaj Rahugana was puffed up thinking I'm a king. He was riding on a palanquin, and one of his palanquin carriers, fell ill and couldn't carry anymore, so the other servants were looking around for somebody that they could replace him with, and they saw Judd Bharat. He was a Paramahamsa, but he was acting like a, you know, a deaf and dumb, you know, crazy person, so no one would bother him. So they recruited him, and he just agreed, but he didn't want to step on ants. So he was jostling the palanquin, and the king began hurling insults at him, because like, what's wrong with you? And after sometime, Judd Bharata spoke to him, and Judd Bharata realized this is a self-realized person I've been offending. So he got down, offered his obeisances to Judd Bharata, and then begged his forgiveness, and then heard from him spiritual knowledge. Also, there's a case where Mukunda took... To Pundarik Vijayaniti. It was Mukunda took Gadadhar Pandit. Gadadhar Pandit was a simple Vaishnav, and Mukunda knew about Pundarik Vijayaniti being on the highest platform of devotional service. So, because he had lived in the same village with him. And when he went to Gadadhar Pandit, he told him, I know where there's a highly elevated Vaishnav, would you like to meet him? And he said, yes, I want to meet a highly elevated Vaishnav. Please take me. So he took him to the house of Pundarik Vijayaniti, and Pundarik Vijayaniti practically lived in a palace. And he lived a very opulent lifestyle. And when Gadadhar Pandit looked in on Pundarik Vijayaniti, he saw that he was on a very expensive bedstead, and that all around him were the accoutrements of luxury. and he was being fanned with a charmer fan. He was chewing some betel, and his hair was oiled with fine oil, and he was leaning back in a posture like a sense enjoyer. And in his mind, Gadadhar Pandit thought, this is a Vaishnav? Where's the elevated Vaishnav? This person looks like a sense enjoyer. And Mukunda realized that that's what he was thinking. He could just see it in his demeanor. So he uttered a verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Aho bhakiyam stanakalakutam. It's a verse about how Krishna is so kind. He's so merciful. Why would anybody take shelter of anyone else? Because Putana, after all, came to try to kill him with poison on her breast. And Krishna accepted Putana as mother. Didn't even consider the poison, just considered that, well, she was trying to be my mother. So he said, who would take shelter of anyone else? This beautiful verse from Uddhava in the Srimad Bhagavatam. When Pundarik Vidyanidhi heard the verse, he went into a frenzy of ecstatic devotion. He thrashed the whole room until there wasn't one piece of pottery or any of the fancy accoutrements left unbroken. And all of his servants came in to try to restrain him and hold him down, but they couldn't do it. His hair went haywire, and he thrashed like that in ecstasy of love of God after hearing that one verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam for hours, and then went into a trance, as almost like he was like in a coma, an ecstatic coma. Gadadhar Pandit, meanwhile, while he was watching this, as soon as it transpired, he only thought came into his mind, I made an aparad. Just by thinking. I thought this person was a materialistic person, not a devotee. And therefore, in my mind, I made an aparad. And he became so disturbed that he had made an offense in his mind that he told Mukunda, I want to take initiation from him to alleviate my offense. So they both went back to Mahaprabhu, and Mukunda said, Gadadhar Pandit wants to take initiation from Pundarik Vidyanidhi, and Mahaprabhu said, do it immediately. So he took initiation from Pundarik Vidyanidhi. But my point was that we should be careful. You know, who we make statements about and you know, where we walk in the world and you know, who we're around. We should just be very careful about that. And if we do happen to make an aparad accidentally, then we should try to rectify it. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about ways to rectify different kinds of aparads when he's, you know, if there are things done severely, you have to go and if there are offenses in the mind, they should be rectified in a certain way. Offenses by the body should be rectified in a certain way. And there's even cases when the person you offended is now no longer physically present of what you're supposed to do to rectify the offenses. So Krishna consciousness, chanting Hare Krishna, is not only the science of chanting, but it's also the science of avoiding Vaishnava aparad and other kinds of aparads as well. Well, we really didn't get to the Ramayana, did we? Yes, Vanamali. Yeah. Well, Dhruva Maharaj, his father actually, he felt great remorse after Dhruva Maharaj left because his father was not did not permit him to sit on his lap because his favored queen would not allow it and said, unless you're born from my womb, don't sit on the lap. That's when he went away. And later on when he came back, his father felt great remorse that he had offended this, you know, his son who was actually now considered to be who was an exalted Vaishnav. So, just so we have a little Ramayana, Satyadev Prabhu, yes? Or if you think of it later, let me know. So for the... Okay. So we just get started with the Ramayan. Satyadev Prabhu will tell us the... speaking of curses, how Ravana, four people who cursed Ravana, setting the stage for his demise later.
So early on, this is before Lord Ramachandra appeared, actually even generations before even King Dasarath appeared, Ravana had become very powerful. And he was traveling through the skies. And the first curse, I think, was he saw a big monkey.
Oh, first was Vedavati.
Oh, Vedavati.
Beautiful woman.
Vedavati?
Vedavati was sitting meditating.
Okay, so Vedavati, right. She was sitting meditating. She was very beautiful. And Ravana wanted to have his way with her, as they say. And he came down and he assumed the form of a very beautiful person, very beautiful human being. And he tried to seduce Vedavati, but she refused all of his advances. And then Ravana, he grabbed her by the hair and said, "Well, you know, I'm just going to take you anyway." And she had some mystic power, so she was able to cut her hair with her hand, and Ravana fell back, and she cursed him.
She said, "I'll come back in my next life, and I'll be the cause of your demise."
Cause of your death. And at that point, she came back to Sita. And at that point, she left her body. And
she burned herself to ashes.
She burned herself to ashes, you know, in a yogic fire. So that was the first curse. Then the second curse is he was traveling in the skies and he saw a big, gigantic monkey.
Well, as he was traveling...
Yeah, actually, you better say it because I don't remember.
All right, well, I'll probably... And he was traveling, then he had this chariot, this gigantic... It was like an island, a city in the sky that he had stolen from Kuvera. He fought with Kuvera and took this traveling island in the sky. It had lakes and valleys and beautiful palaces on it and everything. And then as it was going through the sky, it stopped right in midair. It couldn't go any further. So he was looking around to see which power had stopped the movement of his aircraft. And he looked down and he went down to the ground and he saw this really gigantic monkey and very muscular and kind of like deformed. And it turned out to be Nandi, Lord Shiva's carrier. Sometimes Nandi appears as a bull and sometimes as a big monkey. And, you know, he asked the monkey, what's going on here? And he said, "You're entering into Lord Shiva's area and you cannot go here. This is impassable for people like you. You can't come." So he became angry and he started insulting Lord Shiva and the monkey too. So Nandi said, "Monkeys will appear and be the cause of your demise." He cursed him like that. He said, "The monkeys will be the cause of your demise." And Ravana didn't care for him, so he took his 20 arms and he picked up the hill. It was a gigantic hill, mountain actually, that Lord Shiva was on. And he was going to take it out from the root with his arms. So he dug his arms deep into the hill and he started to rip it out. And just then Parvati lost her balance and she grabbed onto Lord Shiva and said, "What's going on?" And Lord Shiva said, "Oh, don't worry, it's just Ravana." And he put his toe on the hill and he pressed down with his big toe. And from that pressure from Lord Shiva, it crushed Ravana's arms and he was screaming, you know, having his arms crushed under the hill. So all the Rakshasas who traveled with Ravana came to him and they said, "You better pray to Lord Shiva." Because he's Ashutosh, he's easily pleased. So if you pray to him, he'll come and save you, he'll rescue you. So Ravana was actually well educated. He studied all the Vedas, and he knew the Samaveda prayers to Lord Shiva. So he began saying those prayers over and over and over again. So Shiva came. He let him stay there for 100 years in that situation. He finally came, and he rescued him. He relieved them from the pressure, and then said, "You know, be careful. And Ravana said, fine, but can you give me another benediction besides letting me free? He said, what's that? And he said, I would like your weapon, you know, your trident weapon. And so Shiva said, yes, you can take it. So as soon as Shiva turned around and disappeared, the mantras for that weapon, because all the weapons were thrown by mantra, appeared within the mind of Ravana. So he had this powerful weapon of Lord Shiva. So then he was flying around more, and he came close to the earth planet, and he came to Ayodhya. In Ayodhya, there was a great king who was a predecessor of Maharaj Dasarath. And that was the capital of the world, Ayodhya. So Ravana felt that even though he didn't have much regard for human beings, in fact, when he got a boon from Brahma that he couldn't be killed, he left out humans and he left out animals because he thought, well, I didn't even want to add it because it's an insult to me to even mention humans or animals as somebody who might kill me because they're insignificant. And he also thought the same way about this, the emperor who was living in Ayodhya at the time. And therefore, but he thought, I might as well go in and fight him and kill him before I leave, and that way I can just check the earth off as mine too. Because that's what he was doing, basically, flying around everywhere, conquering, fighting with everyone, conquering them, and then saying, you know, I own it. So he fought with the king of Ayodhya. First of all, he killed all of the soldiers. But the king was a great fighter, and he came out and he fought valiantly with Ravana for some time, but was then was defeated. And as he was dying on the battlefield, Ravana began to insult him and say, you know, you're such a fool. You must have been an uncontrolled sense enjoyer to think that you could fight with me. You know, he's dying and he's insulting him on the after he's fought a valiant battle. And the king had accumulated some very powerful pious credits, you know, throughout his life by his intense practices. And he decided at the last breath to use those in a curse to Ravana. And so he told him that a human being will be born from my dynasty later that will be the cause of your demise. Just as he was dying in his last breath, he said that. So then Ravana, he didn't care for that. He just flew off. And Narada Muni intercepted him. Now, he was friends with Narada because Narada knows how to negotiate with everybody, as we know from the Krishna book, with Kamsa. And he began speaking to Narada Muni, and Narada Muni told him, you know, why you... He just wanted to get him away from the earth because he was harassing so many human beings and causing so much disturbance. He said, why are you even dealing with the humans? They're going to die anyway. This is Martyaloka. It's the place of death. They're destined to die. It's like, it's futile. Why are you trying to kill people who are going to die? He said, why don't you go fight with somebody like Yamaraj, who could really, you know, that would be a big thing. So Ravana thought, yeah, I'll go fight Yamaraj. So he took his flying city, and he went to the Yamalok. It describes how he passed through the Vaitarani River, and he went down Yamalok, and he saw all the Yamadutas there, and they were punishing people in hellish ways, throwing them off mountains, and then they would be crushed, and then they would come back to their form and then run away, and the Yamadutas would grab again, throw them over again, and they're being tortured, these living entities. Now, he didn't care a bit whether they were tortured or not. He had no concern that they were being punished, but he started to free them and break them loose from the Yamadutas because he figured if he did that, then Yamaraj would appear and then he could fight with him. And that's just what happened. First of all, the Yamadutas amassed and they began to fight against Ravana, and they were very powerful and they were actually giving some injury to Ravana. And so he took out his Lord Shiva weapon and he fired at them, and they were all burned to ashes, millions of them. So Yamaraj could tell. He was in his palace, and he could tell what was taking place. So he and his associate, Death, then came down from his palace and faced Ravana and had a furious fight. And back forth, they fought until Yamaraj was fed up with Ravana, and he decided, now I'm going to kill him. And he lined up his weapon, and he was just about to annihilate Ravana, and he could have done it. But then, unseen to Ravana, Lord Brahma appeared before Yamaraj, and he said, you can't do this, because I gave him a boon that he can't be killed by any god, and you're a god. So if you kill him, it'll create imbalance in the entire universe, and it'll void the my benediction, and that will be a disturbance to the whole world. So Yamaraj put down his weapon and he walked away. And Ravana thought, I've won. He's afraid of me. He's gone away. So then he flew off again, feeling victorious even over Yamaraj. And then he went over the heavenly planets. He saw another beautiful woman named Ramba, who is the wife of Nalakuvera, who you remember from Nalakuvera and Manigriva. So she was wandering in the forest, and he came down and he forced himself on Ramba. A brutal rape of Ramba. She tried to resist him, and others who saw it take place, they also were powerless against Ravana, because they knew if they lifted a finger, he would just annihilate them. So she ran away after being violated by Ravana, and Nalakuvera, her husband, uttered a curse. Now, he's also a god, so his curse was very powerful, and Ravana knew this. And he said, if you ever try to force a woman again, then you'll die. And Ravana, it came into his mind that I've heard that the curses of these heavenly people, they always come true. He said, but it doesn't matter, because women are attracted to me anyway. So why do I have to force anymore? So I won't do it anymore. But he knew, it was in his psychology already, that if he did try to force another woman, he would die. So that his hesitancy was there. Thus ends the prologue. And then, of course, we come into the birth of Ram, and he and his brothers, Bharat, Lakshman, and Shatrughna, who were all born because King Dasarath didn't have a son. He had no offspring. So he was morose, and all the people knew it, and they were morose also because there was no successor. So he performed a huge sacrifice, an Ashwamedha Yajna. And after the Yajna, which took a year to set up the Yajna and a huge production, a being appeared from the fire of the Yajna and handed over a bowl of this special sweet rice. And he took and instructed him to go give it to his wives. So he did. And they drank the sweet rice and immediately became pregnant with Bharat, Shatrughna, Ram, and Lakshman, who were soon born. I'm just coming up to the point where we're at, so you don't miss anything, because we're going to finish this before the Ram Navami. And then, of course, as he's growing up, he becomes the darling of everyone in Ayodhya, Ram does. And his sons are so brilliant and powerful and wonderful. And then one day, Vishwamitra Muni comes into Ayodhya, and everyone comes to tell Dasarath that this great sage has come to see him. And he bows down before Vishwamitra and says, anything I can do for you, please just let me know. I'm your servant. And Vishwamitra says, sure, just give me Ram. Because there are these two demons who are ruining, they were servants of Ravana, and they were ruining all the sacrifices of the sages. And Vishwamitra could have easily killed them himself, but he's a Brahmin. And part of his yajna was that he couldn't become angry at anyone or would destroy the yajna that he was performing. And the other one is, you know, it's not a Brahmin's duty to use military force, martial force, to bring someone down. So he asked for Ram, and Dasarath was incredulous. He said, anything but that. I'll go, and I'll bring all of my hundreds of thousands of soldiers, and we'll protect the thing. He said, no, I want Ram. And he kept insisting he wasn't going to let Ram go until Vasishtha, his guru, the guru of Duryodhan, pulled him aside and said, listen, you don't know. I know, Vishwamrita knows, but Ram is actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There'll be no problem. And Vishwamrita, he'll give him all the military weapons and everything like that out of his mercy. Besides, he could kill himself. He'll protect Ram, don't worry. So even after that, very reluctantly, Dasarath agreed to let Ram go, and that's where we are now. So Ram is going to the forest with Lakshman because Ram and Lakshman were inseparable from their very birth. Wherever Ram went, Lakshman went. Deepa.
Probably you can continue, otherwise I had one question. Mother Yashoda has the realization that Krishna is the Supreme Personality, but you know how it's amazing how the Yogmaya then again makes them forget, and I was just thinking so that relationship is different, but the relationship of what Nanda Maharaj had with Krishna or with or with Balram, like we see of Dhruva Maharaj, and Uttam with Uttam Pada, doesn't any conflict arise between Krishna and Balram with love of father like Nanda Maharaj?
It went right over my head. I didn't
we
get
can
the question.
Discuss it.
Okay, to be continued. Sounds like a good question, but it sounds like a long answer coming. So I'll get it clearly and then we'll go. Ramachandra ki, Shri Ram Navami ki. So we're coming up on Ram Navami. We're counting down the days. We'll be hearing Ramayana all the way up until that point. If we fix this, I heard it's broken, you know. He fixed it? Oh, okay. Maybe we can have some extended readings, and if everyone can't be here, we'll just do it on camera and we can finish the whole thing. And we have an MSF coming up that's based around Ramachandra's appearance. So we can start any time. We don't have any very specific goals except for, a couple things. One is finishing the Ramayana. Now we're going to have Artik and then Prashadam. And if there's like a 10 or 15 minute period that we can talk, any of the devotees who have been on Sankirtan for the last MSF and have follow-ups, I'd like to just have a quick meeting and talk, because I want to get ready for the Saturday coming up to do our follow-ups so we can do it comprehensively. So if we can do that like right around Prashadam time, that would be ideal. So please keep that in mind. That means anyone who's ever been on Sankirtan, Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki. Shri Shapanishad ki. Shri Ramayan ki. Gaur Premanande Haribo. So we could put all the books in, book stands, everything away quickly and efficiently. We'll have Artik.